On today's episode of Care Under Fire, it's a real privilege to be with Vietnam veteran Sister Cheryl O'Brien. Cheryl served in the RAF as a flight nurse based in Malaysia and flew medevac missions out of Vietnam and within and to Australia. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on to the podcast, Cheryl.
My name is Cheryl O'Brien. In 1964, I commenced my general training at Balmain Hospital. For 4 years, on completion of that, I did my midwifery training at Balmain Hospital. In 1969, in February, I accepted a commission into the Royal Australian Air Force Nursing Service.
Can I ask you what that training was like, and were the senior nurses kind to you, or was it a bit of a baptism of fire in the early days of hospital-based registered nurse training?
You mean my general training?
Yeah.
No, they were very good.
They were?
Yes. Very strict, very strict, but good, solid training. And the same, I had a lovely year at midwifery, delivering over 100 babies. And
wow.
Yes, so it was very good.
Were there many cesareans back then?
Not very many.
Not many, lots of normal births.
Yes, lots of normal births. Really, cesareans were for emergencies.
Yeah.
Sometimes, obviously, elective cesareans for certain people because they knew that they wouldn't be able to deliver vaginally. No. And in 1969, I joined the Royal Australian Air Force Nursing Service. I was then posted to Laverton in Victoria, to RAF Hospital, and I waited. I did just general nursing there in the wards until officer training school started in June. I was then posted to Point Cook, where we underwent 2 weeks training of Air Force law and lectures in aviation medicine. During that time, we were taught to march. Funny. nurses don't march very well, but they do now, I must tell you, having seen them on Anzac Day. Part of that training was also to be experience different issues. We went up in small aircraft there, the windjills. Then we also went in the ejection seat so that we could experience what it was like to be ejected out of an aircraft. And then we also had to do a ditching procedure in Port Phillip Bay. This was the middle of winter, and it was very cold. As we raced down the pier to the crash boat, which was a very large speedboat, we almost put the officer commanding into the water, because we were such a keen to get into the ditching procedure and then we could have a ride around Port Phillip Bay. So we went along out to the pier and we were told, jump in or we'll push you in. So we all jumped in, and then hilarious gales of laughter could be heard as we all tried to climb into the inflatable raft. The more we laughed, the less we could get into the raft. Finally, we all pulled one another aboard, and we were let out, and we got our ride in the speedboat.
Nice.
After the 2 weeks, we were then posted to 3 RAF Richmond, where we continued our training. This included law, survival after air crash, and we learnt then how to configure medevacs in different aircraft, from helicopter, DC-3, Caribou and Hercules. We also had to do a decompression run so that we would be aware of what it was like to suddenly become hypoxic, and we could recognise the signs. During that time, we also had a full mock evacuation procedure in the back of a Hercules with psych patients and all abdominal wounds. These were all simulated, but we were all watched and judged on our ability to handle these situations.
Wow. When I did my pressure training, hypoxic training, they made us do some very simple maths. And I think it was quite simple, but my oxygen saturations, which we were monitoring, were about 78% at the time, and I just wrote too hard and drew a smiley face on the paper. Did you have to do questions?
They gave us questions to answer.
Yeah.
But in those days, pulse oximetry was not around.
Yeah, so it was just about recognising.
Yes, it was just about recognising. And then clearly, if you had an issue, if you couldn't write, you were hypoxic.
Yeah, and then self-rescue with applying a mask.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
How funny.
And also how to survive following a crash. We had a lot of lectures on that. So we did all this training. Obviously, we all graduated, and then we were posted to various bases. I was posted to 3REF Richmond, where I was for about 9 months, and then I was posted to Malaysia. During the time I was at Richmond, that was in 1969, we would sometimes get one medevac, but sometimes three a week, depending on the number of casualties that would be coming through.
Can I ask what your motivation to join the Air Force was? Was that because your dad served?
My father was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
I had one brother already in the Air Force. And I wanted to go into the Air Force. And then my other brother joined the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other brother, he eventually went into the Air Force as well.
So Vietnam was already happening. Did you join with the expectation that you'd serve?
There was always that, and they wanted midwives as well. There was a lot of, in the days when we were at Richmond, the medevacs would come in. All people from New South Wales, they went straight out to Two Military Hospital. The patients who were from Queensland, Victoria, South Australia, Western Australia, and sometimes New Zealanders, they were all transported to their home states or obviously to New Zealand if there were New Zealand people to go. And these were then, we would then transport, in those days a Hercules would leave Richmond and go to Victoria, and then it would come back Richmond, Brisbane, Darwin. It was called the East Coast Run. So then all those soldiers going to those states would go via that. They'd go on stretchers, and the nurses would then take them home, and they'd go to their various army hospitals.
Mm. What sort of injuries were coming out of Vietnam?
In those days, you could have shrapnel wounds, abdominal wounds, leg wounds, amputees, head injuries. Occasionally a patient would be ventilated. These are the early days of ventilation, and they were a bird ventilator because they worked well in the back of a Hercules.
Okay.
Lots of different wounds. There was also medical conditions that people identified with. I can particularly remember one patient coming through, and he was a severe bone marrow suppression. He just had no white cells, and they were transporting him to Victoria. So there was lots of different issues. People could have reactions to the antimalarials, and that would interfere with their bone marrow production, or they could end up with infections, things like leptospirosis from the rats, malaria.
It blows my mind that we were flying in the Hercules in Vietnam and in Afghanistan, and we still are evacuating patients. Of course, now we have the C-17, which is a bit bigger and can take more casualties. But essentially, we were using the same aircraft, and we're still using the same aircraft that you flew in. I've moved patients in 50 years, you know.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes. A Hercules could be configured for 70 stretches. But usually it was only 50.
Yeah.
Because it was manageable. And that used to be two nurses.
Wow.
And sometimes a medical orderly. If there was a patient that was a psych patient, they usually had to be sedated and they had to have a doctor with them all the time. And the same with a ventilated patient.
Hmm.
They needed a doctor and a nurse to look after specifics. All the casualties were categorised so that you would know, and you'd know on the signal that would come through, it would tell you who would be coming on the medevac. First of all, I should tell you that I was one of about 100 people over a period of 10 years. So one, not many trips, but also you were responsible on the ground. When I first was posted to Malaysia, I spent a year on Penang. I'll talk about that shortly, but just finish about the trips into Van Tau and how that went. One flight crew would go to Van Tau and pick up the patients. This was a four to five hour flight. So you'd load the patients and then they would come back to the base in Butterworth. The next night, they would be loaded onto a Hercules and it was a 16 hour flight to Richmond.
Mm.
They didn't stop anywhere and they went straight through. And usually about an hour out before they landed, the whole plane would go very quiet. The men were aware that they were very close to being home.
Yeah.
Many of the girls, you know, did maybe 3-5 trips. It just depended. I had trips into, I had training trips into Van Tau, and then went to Australia. I can remember clearly my first trip that I had to take, you know, see one, do one, teach one.
Mm.
Well, I was on the teach one. And so we get there and they've got the patients lined up on the bus. So I put my colleague on the first bus. I needed to go to the loo, which was about 2 kilometres from the front of the hospital. So I had the... Or person that the sergeant that was loading all the patients, you see me, I'm off to the loo and I'll be back. Don't let that bus go. So when I came back, I said, where's the bus? I sent it, but I'm not on it. All I could do was scream, get me a Jeep. So off I went, hoping that the plane had not taken off.
Yes, that could be a problem.
So that's how we went about it. I actually transported a ventilated patient from Butterworth to Sydney, 16 hours.
Mm.
And we used to have a big pallet that you put on so that people could... It contained a toilet, a small kitchen and things like that. They rang me one time and said, do you want the pallet on? I said, yes, please. The thought I said, no, when I get to the plane... There's two huge aircraft engines up against the stretcher and my patient. Couldn't take them off, too late. So off we went, aircraft engines, the doctor, myself and a medical orderly. So a long haul, and we landed at Sydney Airport and the man was transported to Sydney Hospital, and then we had to fly back to Richmond, only to get out at the other end to make our way all the way back into Sydney.
Logistics.
Yes. Now I'll talk about my time on Penang.
Yes, please.
I was a midwife and so I was posted to Penang. I was there, there were two RA, Princess Mary's Royal Air Force Nursing Service nurses. They were posted into Penang. One of these ladies would eventually become a very dear friend and still is today. She was Irish. As the only midwife on the island at that time, we were responsible to transport labouring ladies to the British Army Military Hospital, the maternity hospital. And you have to understand that whilst Penang Island is like an irregular circle, The roads didn't, in those days, didn't join at the top.
Okay.
So the Gurkhas were on one side and the British Army Hospital was on the other. So you had to go in the ambulance all the way out, pick up the labouring lady and bring her back right to the other side. So this would take be a journey of a few hours. The roads aren't lovely highways. They were very narrow strips. On the island were 5,000 dependents. These included Royal Air Force, British Army, Australian Air Force, and a Gurkha battalion.
The Nepalese?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the time I was there was a curfew. There had been a communist uprising, so they had imposed a curfew from 6 in the morning to 6 at night. Over the year I was there, eventually that curfew narrowed. But in those days, if you needed assistance, you put a sheet over the front gate. No mobile phones in those days. Only a few landlines were available. So the service police used to drive around up all where the married quarters were, and then they'd ring and say, there's a sheet over the front fence in such and such a street, and off we'd go in the ambulance to find out what the issue was.
So that could mean a lady's in labour, there's a sick child, there's someone that needs medical assistance of any type.
Indeed.
Wow, what a way to call for help.
Yes.
Hang up a sheet and hope someone sees
it.
Yes.
it worked very effectively.
Wow.
Yes, we on Penang we ran a 24-hour, 24/7 clinic, medical clinic, which was had on-call doctors. If we had an issue, for example, if I'd got a call, which I did, a fitting child, I would call the doctor to come in and meet me, and I would go out in the ambulance to get the child and bring them back into the medical centre. The RAF and the Australian Air Force ran the SAR helicopters. I was frequently called the SAR team to transport a patient to the main base. You have to understand, in those days there was no big bridge like there is connecting Penang to the mainland. It was all by ferry. So you had to organise your trip to the to coincide with the departure of the ferry going to the other side across the strait. I transported many labouring ladies, and I did deliver one Gurkha baby. This lady made no sound, absolutely nothing, and just said to me, and out came this little baby. So we had the ambulance pull over to the side, caught the baby, and then we continued on to the British Army Hospital and handed over the babe and mum.
You really were, had to be a jack of all trades. You were working in basically a paramedic, a nursing role, out of hospital, in aircraft.
You don't think of that, but all the training, yes. The other thing is that if there was an accident on the island of Penang, they were transported immediately to the Penang General. Many a serviceman owes his life to the work done at Penang General. This was basic. They had third class, second class, first class wards. If we had a serviceman from all those services involved, we would go down to the hospital and get them, put them in an ambulance and take them to the main base. My biggest surprise was I went to pick up this patient, and I hadn't seen a giving set made with rubber tubing and a bung since I had just first started my nursing, and then plastic disposables came in.
Mm.
I was just amazed.
Sort of World War II
they
era.
They were, but the work they did was unbelievable. if you went down to the hospital in the middle of the night, the most interesting thing is you'd be stepping over addicts lying on the waiting, people waiting for treatment with their little wooden pillows. It was truly amazing sometimes to see, and I think it makes you realise what a lucky country you live in.
Yeah.
At the completion of 12 months, the matron came to me and asked, look, I haven't got another midwife, could you stay the other 6 months? So at the completion of 12 months, I was then transferred back to the main base, and this is where I did my 3 medevacs into Vietnam and one to Australia. And also we still worked, we did some midwifery work and then worked night duty and depending on which ward you were in. One night, my friend, who we used to do night duty, she liked the ladies' surgical ward and the men's medical, and I had the surgical ward and the, you'd call it accident emergency today, it was just the casualty. We received a phone call. A Gurkha had been bitten by a pit viper. So, and that was some miles up the road at Sanjipitani. Well, I'm sure that we could hear the ambulance from the time it left the base there till it pulled into our base. They just used to get into the vehicle, the ambulance, the Gurkhas, and they drove straight down the middle. Everybody got off the road. lights and flashing plus siren. So I've got my resuscitation bag, I've got the doctor on site, we're ready, so I leap into the back of the ambulance. No patient. So I turned around and I said, where's the patient? I turned around and there's 4 Gurkhas, and they said, here he is, and they're all standing at attention with his legs straight out. He was the one that had been bitten.
And he was standing up.
Yes, saluting.
Yes. Saluting.
Yes.
So it's really respectful and unnecessary.
Yes. So they suddenly thrust. I said, where's the snake? They produced, I won't say the brand, but they produced this bottle of orange drink, not fresh orange. And in here was the snake.
Oh.
Dead. I have never drunk that brand again, ever. We put him into the surgical ward. In those days, a snake bite was always given a vitamin B injection. Not only did it sting a bit, but it smelt, and it used to calm people down so that they didn't feel as though that they would die. The gentleman was lucky, he survived, he was wearing gaiters, so he only got one puncture and not very much of a puncture at that, so he survived well.
Was there antivenom?
No antivenom in those days.
So just airway support and
absolutely.
Try and...
The old ABC,
yeah.
Airway, breathe and circulate. They think they did have some antivenom, but that used to come from the Penang General Hospital. They had a big serum there, centre, and in a very big long glass cage, about a 6-foot cage, 2 inches thick, was a very big, giant, angry cobra.
Oh.
And they used to milk that for to make. It was very, I suppose, they would be the earliest of antivenin that you would get.
Fascinating. Do you think your training had prepared you well for the such variety of casualties you treated?
I think my general training did. It certainly did. Certainly my midwifery. Because I was in a smaller hospital, it was only a 300-bed hospital, 350. And yes, but there are a lot of things when you go into the service that you aren't going to come across, but then you meet different things. I mean, that's not the only snake bite I treated. Some man came in, he'd been bitten, it was when I was in Penang, he'd been bitten, but he'd caught the snake alive. So Bernie came into the treatment room and the thing, of course, jumped out of the bag that he had it in.
Wow.
So you can imagine how quick I exited the room.
D for danger.
Anyway, but however, he survived. Yes.
This is probably backtracking a little bit, but all those service men and their families that were in Butterworth, were they doing logistic support for Vietnam, or was that more of a training base at that time, training, staging? What were their roles?
At Butterworth, there was a squadron of Mirage. So they were there in their capacity. There's obviously always search and rescue. The Hercules used to come in. In those days, it was a political thing. They used to fly the patients into Butterworth and then they went to Sydney. But those political questions really weren't raised. Mm. And the thing is that I think now they realise in those days there was very limited support for the wives and the children, particularly young girls who they married early because the boyfriends had got, or they were engaged or whatever, they got posted overseas. They did not have access to their mothers and fathers. There's not the computers, the phones, and the technology that you have today that they would be able to communicate. Many times they, I think, would feel despair at times. And I think, you know, if you've got a baby that cries all night and the husband's got to go to work and the CO wants to know why you're falling asleep and it's a colicky baby, I have to say, We did have a couple of investigations. They were psychiatrists and things like came through. And I can remember I was very open and forthright because I had spent a year on Penang. And we would try very much to support them as best we could. But there were a couple of tragic circumstances. Mm. And I think now there's a lot more support. If you were posted, you often could be posted away overseas for 2 years with no ability to get home to visit family and have that support.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very isolating for families, absolutely. Yes. So you take on a bit of a nursing, mothering role at the same time to look after them. Yeah. Mm. And did you get any time off and have any sort of social life while you were over there?
Yes. We do 2 weeks night duty and we'd have 4 or 5 days off. We'd go shopping. Shopping's very good. Retail therapy is very good. Yes, and there were different things that we did and functions. We were able to have a few short trips away. I had 2 weeks leave and went home to Australia for 2 weeks and came back, stopped in Darwin, the coldest night they'd had for 50 years. And I'd been in Sydney in the winter and come out of the tropics, so I was frozen. But that all settled down. Minor things that happen, but, you know, on the whole, you get there, and we're always very supportive of one another. And I think that's people looked after different groups. When I did my was transferred to Richmond, I underdid what they called MOSU course, Medical Operations Support Unit, and my course was number 2. So there was usually 6 or 8 people in those courses, and you'd find that people would follow up on one another. And if you were in, for example, in Richmond or something, or the hospital, you all looked out for one another. Didn't mean that you lived in people's pockets, but you kept an eye on how somebody was managing or coping with their life and what was happening.
Mm, yeah, the sisterhood and looking out for each other.
Now, the time that I was in Butterworth the first time. I had one brother in the Air Force there. He was there for about a bit longer than me, a bit over 2 years. And I also had a brother on the ground in Vietnam. He was with the engineers.
And, of course, you had a really outstanding record, or the RAF had a really good record of 3,164 patients medevac from Vietnam. None were lost during flight.
Why
do you think that was?
Well, first of all, they wouldn't put Vung Tau was very specific. They had to meet certain criteria to fly. They had to be safe. So they couldn't be transported to Butterworth if they weren't safe. They had to stay on the ground and they were deemed safe. And then they would then be looking, and they would get assessed again when they'd get to Butterworth. The doctors would assess them again, particularly the very serious cases. Mm. Now, I can remember one patient when I was at Richmond. I was on night duty and I got up to find, very funny, all the entire nursing quarters was empty. I thought, oh, something's going on. So I toddle off to work, only to discover that one of the fellows who had arrived, he had both legs amputated and he had got an infection and he had bled. And he then went to theatre and he eventually survived. They got him recovered enough to transport him to Melbourne. Years later, when we had a reunion here, a Vietnam reunion, a fellow who had known him had come to the reunion service, and he was able to tell me that he did survive, but succumbed many years later. One of the fellows in our sub-branch here, we worked out that he had come to Richmond when I was there, but we didn't run into one another. He had been shot, and he went straight, I explained to him that he would have gone straight through to Two Mill Hospital. Recently, I was asked to be guest speaker at the Women's Veterans Anzac Service in Penrith. A gentleman came up to me and said at the luncheon, he had been on an aircraft being medevaced to Australia. And he said, we got as far as Singapore and the Hercules broke down. Oh, I said, my very dear friend who lives in Lura, she was the flight nurse in charge of that flight. So we had a good long chat. And then he said, now, do you know this man? And it turned out to be the gentleman in the sub-branch, Billy Wilcox. I'm sure Bill will not mind if I mention his name. And I said, yes, he comes to the pool and for coffee. He said, I thought he was in Oberon. I said, he is. So I said, if you want to give me all your particulars, I'll pass that on. So I came in the following Friday and gave all these particulars to Bill. And he was chuffed because he said, oh, I've lost his contacts. That's really good.
That's wonderful, because you rarely would know what happened to the patients you've nursed along the way. But when you have those connections years later, it must just be lovely to yes. Know how it all turned out. Yes. You miss that, the yes. end of the story sometimes yes. when you drop someone off or yes. you've transported someone.
Yes. Yeah. A funny story. When I went to this as guest speaker in Penrith, somebody came up to me and she said, oh, I'm Pat Johnson. I don't think she'll mind either. Too late, Pat. She said, we were at Richmond together. I said, oh, I can't place you. I'll have to have a think about it. Anyway, a bit later on, just after I'd given my short talk, I remembered who she was. So when we were at lunch, I went looking for her. And I said, Pat Johnson, where are you? I'm here. I said, I remember you now. She said, why is that? I said, you were posted to Darwin and rolled the ambulance. These were old, big ambulances. You could not go above 50 if you did. They rolled.
Okay.
Anyway, she said to me, well, that's nice. Now you've told the whole table. And I said, oh, so many years ago, I wouldn't worry. After being in Malaysia, I was then, for another 9 months, I was then posted to RAF Base East Sale, where I was there until I elected to be discharged from my short service commission and went on to do to lead a civilian nursing life. I must say I had I have very fond memories of East Sale. We had to be prepared all the time for aircraft crashes. Usually at least once a year there'd be an aircraft crash. So the doctor had me all trained up so that I could start IVs and be his right-hand man. In those days we used to have the ambulance, and in the afternoon we used to send out the ambulance and they would go and the tower would direct them to different places. The whole base was made up into grids and they'd send them to different places. One day I came back and I said, where have you all been? Oh, they've had us all over the place, ma'am. I said, okay, tomorrow I'll go, but I'm going to sit right back in the ambulance so they can't see. So after about half an hour the next day of going all over the place, I said to the driver and the other medical audience, I said, just slide the microphone back and we'll wait for the next order. And I said, ambulance to tower, say again. And there was a big long pause. She's in the ambulance. That's all I heard. But when I went to the mess for lunch, there was a big smile on the squadron leader's face. He said, you got them. There's many funny stories that you have, but we did set up a ward at the bottom of the little hospital so that we could have, if we had an aircraft crash. One day we had three practice runs. We had one at about 8:05. Shortly after that, he said, so we got everything back. Oh, we've got to have a cup of tea first. I says, no, we get everything back to get back together. So we're ready. I said, I'd reckon I'd wait half an hour and they'd have another one. Yes, they did. And so we got all back together and then they said, and when are they going to do another? Oh, I said, 3:05, smoko time. That's exactly what they did. And they would have either a Dakota or a Caribou down the end of the field or a 747, and they would have casualties and they would be all tagged. So they'd come up to the hospital and we would have to triage them and look after them in that fashion. But I exited Sale and with lots of fond memories of my service.
Did you find it hard to adjust back into civilian life?
At times, yes, but because I wanted to go and do an intensive care course, but they had offloaded me and I ended up doing a renal course. That's all right, that didn't matter, and I just then progressed from there to different things. I was there in Melbourne for about a year and then went to Sydney. I was going to America. I had a job. So I stayed 6 months in Sydney and then took off for America, where I was there about 21 months.
Mm-hmm. And you also worked in Saudi Arabia, didn't you?
I did. I came back and worked again in Sydney. And then, I did do my intensive care course at Sydney Hospital, where I learnt unbelievable amount. Mm. And from there, I went to be in charge of the transplant unit and went to North Shore Hospital when we moved. And then I did go to Saudi Arabia and I worked in a big dialysis unit there. And I was there for 3 years and I came home for two. And then I went back for four. I went to get a mortgage and I went back to get rid of it.
Interesting culture, working in Saudi.
Yes, very interesting culture. You have to, it's best to say, look, there are rules that if you get caught breaking them, you will be sent home. But there are many rules that you could bend, and you have to be that you're in another country, and you have to be respectful. And that's the only way, I think, when you go into another country. Then after my time in Saudi Arabia, I came back and I worked in dialysis again. But then I went to work at Westmead ICU, which I was there for 3 years. And then I came back to Bathurst and worked in the intensive care coronary care unit for the last 10 years of my career.
So you began nursing as a 17-year-old in 1964 and then retired.
At 63. It was really due to ill health.
47 years of looking after people when they're most vulnerable. And you would have seen incredible change in the profession and the technology.
Yes, it's unbelievable when you think of the change in technology. Now, my father died when I was 19. He was 52. And they didn't. He had cardiac disease. He died with his second MI. That's myocardial infarction, heart attack. They didn't split chests in those days. They didn't have a fraction of the medication they have today. So, with the technology and the change, and everything that has been learnt and the research, it is truly amazing.
Is there anything you look back on and have a giggle and think, I can't believe we used to do that to patients back in the day?
Well, yes. I was talking, somebody was talking to me about they were having like knee surgery or hip surgery. And I said, look, back in those days when I was a student, 2 days before we used to shave the leg. Then they were treated with and the leg was wrapped up. The next day, it was done again, and then a third day on the morning of their operation, this was all surgically cleaned down with this special treatment solution and wrapped up again, and then they went to theatre. Well, that's not done anymore. And there's so many different things.
Yeah.
I mean, in that time, cardiac monitoring came into... We did ventilate patients. They used to be on an old bird ventilator. I can always remember when I went to the... They started this new cardiac program. So I went round to the roster sister and said, I want to go there. Well, she said, sit down, nurse. And I said... And she said, well, I can't send you there. I said, why not? I'm one of the senior nurses. I should be able to go. No, you've got too much experience with the ventilator, so I have to say no. So, well, I suppose eventually it did work out right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What do you think the biggest medical lessons learnt were out of the Vietnam era?
Certainly that retrieval, which they did, you're talking about a fit young force. So therefore, it's not like different ages in traffic accidents and debilitating disease. You've got a group of fit young men. But the simple thing is that they, resuscitation, it's that first hour. They refer to it now as the golden hour. And the medics on the ground were probably responsible for a lot of those lives saved, because they started fluid resuscitation and they got them medevaced out and into the hospital as quickly as they could. They now realise that that is probably one of the best ways to save lives. The quicker the action in that first hour, a couple of hours, is best. I think also, with that war, a lot of countries around the world then set up their retrieval services and took it from there.
Yeah, absolutely key to the chain of survival.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I know there was a lot of resistance in the political sphere around Vietnam. When you returned, did you ever sort of feel a bit out of place? You know, you went there to help and...
Yes. No, that was very hard. I can remember when we were at Richmond, a big tent went up, and of course the press in those days were all at the front gate. Well, what's that tent? And so we were just told there is no tent. So when we went out, we said, there's no tent. We can't see a tent. And it used to drive. So that's fine. But yes, the press were very difficult. And these were the days of, like, the mail system. Like, the post service decided that they wouldn't weren't going to deliver mail. So there was a program, Punch a Postie. Poor postie.
Yeah.
Anyway, there were lots of and big marches that were against the wall. When I got out, I can remember one particular incident. I was in my uniform. I was still in eSale, and I used to do like a safe hand run, take documents down to Victoria Barracks, and I was shopping, and some woman just came up and spat on me.
Wow.
And
disgusting.
And another and then when I got out of the service and I had mentioned that I had been in the service, the doctors berated me because, well, we could have had all these kidney machines if it wasn't for that war. And I just said to them, look, I chose to serve my country and you should respect that.
Yeah.
And after that, they never said a word.
Well said, yeah.
It's the only, you've got to, sometimes you've just got to come back. The lady that spat on me, the bystanders took care of her.
Mm.
They just abused her.
Yeah, it's just disgusting behaviour.
So I just went and got in the car and went away.
Mm.
But it does have an impact on you.
Yeah, yeah. Really need to remember that regardless of your political opinions, everyone who wears the uniform has signed up to serve and to protect Australia.
Absolutely.
And our interests. And
yes.
And
let me tell you, if there is a war tomorrow, who will they call on? If there's an incident, for example, if there's a cyclone or whatever happens, who do they call on? It's the military.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter which branch, but they're in there as first responders.
The people that are willing to do the job that the armchair critics at home will not.
Will not, yeah. No.
What advice would you give to younger veterans who've discharged and are moving on with their civilian life?
I think one of the things was that you realise you know that you've got issues when you get out, if you've been either at a peacekeeping or in a war zone. You will have issues. Everybody will have issues. I think I'd like to say that I feel that there are some things now in place, but if you need help, get it. Don't leave it. Don't struggle with it. I know I did for a while. I came to the sub branch, and thank goodness for a couple of military advocates that they assisted me. I got the help I needed, which is amazing because I didn't think I needed it.
Hmm.
But I am here today, a much better person, and I still see somebody twice a year. It does make a difference, and it is very hard sometimes for transition because within the service there's a very strict order that you follow, and you've got to learn to make that transition. It can be very hard when you need to get out of the service and you've got a family, or you might not have a family, but you need bricks and mortar, you need to pay the rent, buy the food, pay the utilities, all of those things. So it can be very hard and it can be very confronting. But keep in contact with people you know and try and catch up with people who can direct you in the right direction. And there's some very good organisations around that can get you to those particular people that you need.
The RSL being just one that you're very involved with.
Yeah. Yes, the sub-branch. But we've also have here, which is very good, we've had a number of people come, like, from Soldier On, Beyond Blue, they've all come and talked. You find that these men were veterans and they provide wonderful support. You can phone them, you can speak to them, they will help you get over that hurdle that sometimes is there.
Yeah. Cheryl, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. It's a real honour, to be honest, to be able to record just snippets of your story. And thank you for your outstanding contribution to nursing, and thank you for your service.
Thank you. Thank you for your service.